Hi, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of KleptoCast, the podcast series from the Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative. My name is Casey Michelle, and my guest today is Matthew Solomon, a senior economist with Global Financial Integrity, also known as GFI. Matthew worked for more than 30 years as an economic advisor to members of the U.S. Congress, as well as their staff, eventually serving as chief economist for the Senate Committee on the Budget. Matthew is also the author, alongside GFI's Joseph Spangers, of an enlightening and, in a sense, dispiriting, a new report examining the magnitude of illicit financial flows in and out of developing countries from 2005 to 2014, detailing the trillions of dollars that have transferred between countries unregulated and unmonitored. So, Matthew, it's great to have you with us today. For listeners who aren't steeped in following these illicit financial flows, can you give us kind of a top-line overview of some of the findings contained in this report? How much money are we discussing here?
Oh, we're discussing quite a lot. First of all, Casey, thank you for having me on the podcast, and thanks for your interest in our work. This particular report you mentioned is the kind of the seventh report we've had since 2008 addressing the question of trade-related illicit flows. And just to describe what we're after, we again, as we have in the past, we're taking a high elevation approach to coming at a an estimate of the global magnitude of trade-related flows. Our focus is on developing countries, and we're aiming to address one simple but very important question. And that question is, are such trade-related illicit flows significant in magnitude? The question is important. I'll just take a moment, and we can return to it later, perhaps. The question is important because the identification of significant illicit flows into or out of any country signals the presence of significant social costs. The economists who may be listening would associate that phenomenon with rent seeking. That's jargon. We can talk more about that perhaps, but it's this identification of numerical magnitude of something we can measure with something that's much more difficult to measure, but is certainly highly correlated with social costs. Developing countries are really most vulnerable to these costs because they can undermine efforts by governments to steer their economies toward things, you know, laudable aims like sustainable growth, and to make progress on laudable social objectives such as poverty and inequality reduction. They also work to further corrode public trust and governance, as well as the credibility of every aspect of policy, social policy, fiscal policy, monetary policy. The credibility of those policies can be undermined by a country's tolerance or toward the presence of these costs. Well, we basically use publicly available data on bilateral merchandise trade, mostly from the IMF, as you said, over the 10-year period ending in 2014, and we apply conservative assumptions to address this question of magnitude. And in that, we find that the bottom line takeaway is trade-related illicit flows, and therefore the associated social costs, are both significant and persistent. Some particulars. We find in our estimation that outflows of trade-related IFFs, that's illicit financial flows, I'll probably slip into acronym world more than once, estimated outflows from the developing world to advanced countries averaged at least 4.5% of total developing country trade. That is exports plus imports, that's total trade, over the period. That translates in 2014 to about $620 billion of outflows, and about, and then that's about 2% of total developing country GDP. Estimated inflows, on the other hand, of these trade-related illicit flows, and these are moving from the advanced economies into developing and emerging economies, they averaged a larger amount in our estimates, at least 9.5% of total developing country trade over the 10 years. And to illustrate that in dollars, that's about $1.4 trillion of inflows estimated, or it's, these are these are low estimates. There are at least $1.4 trillion in 2014 and at least 4.5% of GDP in that year. Taken together, outflows plus inflows, they amount to a conservative estimate of 14% of total trade on average over the decade. I want to emphasize, for a lot of reasons we may or may not want to get into, these are conservative estimates and very large numbers.
Okay.
And that's kind of the nutshell.
I was going to say, one of the most fascinating aspects, at least for me, that I took away from reading through the report, it deals with just how steady these inflows and outflows have remained over the years that you and your colleagues studied. And, you know, you mentioned that this is the latest in a series of reports going back to, I believe you said, 2008. Why is it, from your perspective, or what are a handful of the reasons from your perspective that these rates have remained as steady as they have? And just as a brief follow-up, which regions in your research have proven most susceptible to these illicit financial flows?
Okay. As to the persistence of these significant flows, I would suspect we could probably fill more than a podcast. Again, we're taking a very high elevation view, and the answer really boils down to tolerance and encouragement of such flows by many things, both in the advanced world and in the developing world. We find, we know, and as you know, at the Kleptocracy Initiative, the abiding of corruption and illicit activity is a deeply culturally entrenched phenomenon. We often think of that in terms of developing countries, and I won't expand on that. But we also find it in such things as the business cultures in advanced countries, where shady activity is part of the business model, and it's very hard for individuals, well-meaning individuals, in any of these contexts to take a stand and say, okay, this is wrong, I'll fix it.
Yeah.
It's hard for individual countries to fix it. If I'm, tolerating some amount of illicit flows in my country, I want to change it. It's bad, but companies will just go to the next country. So there are a lot of factors underlying this. In dollar terms, the number rises, but you're right in focusing on the, kind of propensity, the illicit flow estimate relative to total trade.
Sure.
That is stable. And there are some things maybe we can talk later about ways in which this particular brand of illicit flows can be addressed in practice.
Yeah. Right.
Your second question was about regions. Pardon me. The results vary to whether we're talking about inflows or outflows. I guess the result that absolutely corresponds to, conventional wisdom on this, outflows as a percent of total trade are largest for sub-Saharan Africa.
Okay.
So, for example, we're recording on average about 4.5% of developing countries' total trade is associated with illicit outflows. We, for sub-Saharan Africa, we're getting numbers like 7.5% at least.
Yeah.
On the flip side, for inflows, developing Europe, that's basically Eastern Europe, appears to account for the largest propensity, the highest propensity for illicit inflows. So the average there for all developing countries on inflows is about 9.5% of total trade. For developing Europe, we're getting 12.4%.
So
we do, in the report, we do have a regional breakdown. Asia is, for example, is a large region and comprises a lot of activity, and so their results tend to be close to the average. So on Asia, for example, on inflows, it's about 9.7%, very close to the average for all developing countries, and so forth.
And I think one of the things that the report obviously highlights and certainly makes clear is that there is no region that is left untouched by this phenomenon, either as it pertains to inflows or outflows, developing versus developed.
Yes.
Every region is certainly involved to a greater or lesser extent than the global average. One of the things that the report also details are some of the more prominent methods of illicit financial outflows, including things like trade misinvoicing and balance of payments leakage. Why, in your research, why is it that these tools have become so prominent when it comes to at least outflows?
Okay. Predominantly, as you correctly note, trade misinvoicing is by far the largest location of illicit flows. In the way we're defining them, we are defining them as trade-related, and we are defining them as related to merchandise trade in particular. Mm-hmm. Given that, trade misinvoicing is the lion's share, and in case of inflows, is nearly all of it.
Okay.
So I can speak about that if you want to talk about the balance payments leakages further, about which we know a lot less. We can do that. But let me just say, the opportunity or trade opportunities, what we're picking up or what we're able to detect is movements of value from one place to another through goods trade, and we're focusing on developing versus advanced countries as the IMF defines, and this is we're taking, as I say, a very high elevation look at it, but this is on the ground, a very real phenomenon.
Right.
None of this is news to people who are attempting to do things about this in the developing world. Yeah. At least those that are willing to admit it.
Yeah.
So the phenomenon is real. It's long standing.
Yeah.
I don't know. Would it help for me to describe exactly what misinvoicing entails?
Yeah, I think so. Just a quick overview of what actual trade, because one of the things the report notes, I think it was trade misinvoicing represents, what was it, 87% or thereabouts of the total measure of illicit financial outflows. So this isn't something that is negligible. This isn't something that you can study the phenomenon with while ignoring trade misinvoicing. So yeah, do you have just a quick overview of what that phenomenon entails?
Yes. So trade misinvoicing ultimately involves false trade declarations,
okay.
And I can illustrate that. So on any given trade of a particular good between two countries, false declarations can arise from one of four possibilities or some combination thereof. An importer in one country understates the value of the goods received. That's an inflow, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
An exporter in a country overstates the value of the goods shipped, overstates, that too is an inflow.
Mm-hmm.
Switching to outflows, an importer overstates the value of goods received, and an exporter understates the value of goods shipped.
Okay.
So just as a matter of taxonomy, those are the four possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the motivations for such behavior can vary. The data and methods underlying our high elevation approach to this really can't distinguish between alternative motives, so I want to state that at the outset. Other research, for example, at GFI and elsewhere, indicates that some of the misinvoicing can be motivated by tax evasion, but to actually stand behind a numerical estimate, such research would really require more detailed data and country-specific information on tariffs, tax structures, things like that, as well as enforcement.
Yeah.
Kind of information that we simply cannot feasibly bring to bear on this global exercise.
Right.
The important point underlying the question, and I'll get to a specific illustration in a second, the important point with respect to your question is this. These false declarations are detectable, albeit imperfectly, because the parties to trade located in different countries independently declare values of the trade to the respective customs authorities, and ultimately those customs declarations find their way into the publicly available highly aggregated data published by the IMF, and which is mostly the basis of what we're doing here, and the UN Comtrade data, which are very related in some senses, excellent data. How does it work? Okay, Casey, suppose you and I operate different businesses in different countries, and we agree on a trade. So the agreement is you agree to ship me $1 million of your product, and I agree to pay you. Mm-hmm. That's simple. Nothing wrong there. And, of course, you are an honest businessman, and you declare the value of your export at $1 million to customs officials in your country. Mm-hmm. And, unfortunately, I'm not so honest. So I find a reason, perhaps to avoid import duties, for example, and that's fairly common, mm-hmm. to understate the value of my imports, say, at $800,000 when I declare the transaction to customs officials in my country. Okay, that's happening between you and me, and there's a discrepancy. Ultimately, my behavior there and all kinds of other behavior occurring between all kinds of trades get folded into what becomes a discrepancy in the aggregate bilateral data.
Right.
Our bit, my bit actually, is just this 200,000 shortfall in my country's imports of that good from your country relative to your reported exports of that good to my country.
Right.
Every trade generates two reports, and there are legitimate reasons that they may not match, but there are also illegitimate reasons.
Okay. Right.
As far as the technical exercise goes, I won't go into this unless you want me to. This is the basic problem we're all facing. No illicit flows announce themselves.
Yeah, right.
We are in a situation where we need to tease out some part of these discrepancies that's perhaps explainable and legitimate,
right.
Like transport margins that I as an importer would add to my valuation, but you as an exporter wouldn't. And tease those things out and see what's left and see how it aggregates that way over countries.
I was going to say, I would certainly want to get to policy recommendations, but before we get there, because there were some fascinating tools that were discussed in the report, but before I ask about that, Matthew, there's another section of the report that notes that there seems to be at least some form of momentum, at least within these multilateral organizations like the UN, recent conferences that may be pushing toward potential increased oversight as it pertains to things like trade misinvoicing. Can you take us through just a few of these recent multilateral agreements that have come out over the past year or two aimed at combating IFS?
I'm not the best person to we have some policy people here,
okay.
Heather Lowe and Liz Conflone, who are much more adept at going through the agreements per se.
Mm.
The momentum is laudable, and it is focused on a larger objective of basically curtailing illicit activity or illicit flows. So along those lines, and I can mention some of the efforts, we have this gathering movement worldwide, and you know this very well at Kleptocracy Initiative,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Toward increased transparency.
Right.
You're championing this, and so are others, and this is, on the whole, a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
The best example, and I do think that some of this has got to be motivated by advanced countries' experience with the financial crisis, in which lack of transparency had serious long-term social costs. There are similar, as you know, movements to curtail money laundering. Also, the movements to identify beneficial ownership or better identify beneficial ownership,
mm-hmm.
Of legal entities. I think Laura Biard in a recent podcast went into this in detail,
yeah.
with you and much better than I can. So the very idea of just basically pushing for public registries,
right.
of corporations would be immensely helpful. There's the related work at the OECD, the BEPS work, mm-hmm. Ought to be mentioned in this regard, as well as the public movements to get multinational enterprises to some extent publicly account for their their income, their assets on a country by country basis. So right. that too is a critical step toward curtailing right. illicit flows globally. With respect to the issue of misinvoicing, it's actually the case that countries can take relatively inexpensive steps to hold their customs authorities to account, or just to superimpose some accountability and thereby reduce the prevalence of misinvoicing. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of related efforts related to what we're reporting on here in our high elevation study
right.
At identifying risky transactions.
Right.
Okay. I would say I would add that GFI has a related effort, actually a product we're hoping to make available to entities, both the advanced and developing world. It's called GF Trade, and we are we're basically using large-scale, highly specific data, actual data on trade in between advanced countries and among advanced countries and between developing countries and so on, just massive data sets okay. to basically allow a customs official on the ground to say, okay, here I have something and here's a declaration on, say, the price of this transaction. Is that reasonable given all the other millions of trades made, over the past couple of years?
Right.
Is this a reasonable price?
Right.
And tax authorities can, look over their shoulder, can review the data, can review, this was flagged as a potentially suspicious trade or not. And there's just layers of accountability that come with that. And it's
right.
relatively easy in the sense that these data are available
right.
and could and should be used.
Right.
To that end. So I'm hoping I'm getting at your question.
There, no, you are.
Maybe. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, because that actually leads me, Matthew, into what I guess would be my final question as it pertains to recommendations moving forward. We've discussed recent movement toward increasing oversight, increasing transparency, increasing data availability to those individuals, those actors on the ground. As you mentioned, one of those being beneficial ownership registries. And again, GFI is certainly by no means the only organization pushing for an increased applicability of a beneficial ownership registry, nor is illicit financial flows the only area in which a beneficial ownership registry would benefit just a broader society. The handful of the policy recommendations put forth in this report, I wanted to get your take. What kind of impact on the ground would these policy recommendations, if and when they are implemented, what kind of impact would they have? Would this be a negligible, although real, dent, or is this something that could take a kind of full-scale approach to helping really tamp down on the further expansion of IFFs?
Okay. Well, that's a great question. Again, I'm trying to figure out how to answer it in a comprehensive way, but also in under 2 minutes or so.
Yeah.
How effective would they be? Okay. If we just start with the case of misinvoicing, well, let's step back. The general nature of we don't really observe illicit flows. Mm-hmm. And as we know, say, from something we know a lot more about, which is financial regulation, we do know that risky activity goes to the darkest corner of the house. So in a sense, shining a light in one room could divert activity elsewhere. However, it also raises the cost of illicit activity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's significant, too. That could have an effect on curtailing it. So in the sense of how effective it would be, let's take a look at the big problem. that we're all facing, every group concerned with these activities. We know that ultimately curtailing illicit activity requires fundamental cultural changes. So in a sense, and those are difficult, and in a sense, we can be confident that we're moving in the right direction. I don't think we'll ever be confident that we've eradicated this activity. Sure. It's just a part of human nature.
Right.
So certainly cultural norms must shift. This is especially difficult in developing countries where corruption has really been rife. Mm. But I want to emphasize it's also difficult in countries like ours, advanced countries, where business cultures and norms have, as I said earlier, become tolerant of such activity.
Right.
Some of this activity is outrageous, and much of it may even be legal. That's a problem.
Okay.
At root, what we're after is trying to get a better social distribution of resources and rewards.
Sure.
In every place. And the social costs will not resolve themselves, because a situation where you have, if you picture a situation where individuals are living and they just have to live in a society where there's corruption, it becomes kind of a cost of doing business or just conducting your life. No individual really has an incentive to buck the system.
Right.
And no, stellar examples like the Enron debacle many years ago here, we see how the incentives inside a large corporation are really running against whistleblowers and people who just take it upon themselves, okay, I'm gonna do something about this. So what the efforts on every aspect of curtailing illicit flows, and I want to say, for example, the effort, the kind of thing, the very practical thing I discussed earlier with GF Trade, this idea that little, relatively small expands can allow a customs authority to exert a new layer of accountability on its people, or something not covered by our report, but for example, regulating wire transfers.
Hmm.
I mean, this very same kind of identification procedures, technical procedures, could be applied by an FIU, and they are applied around the world in some cases, to just monitoring wire transfers, just saying, okay, that, looking at wire transfers over time and saying, okay, that's suspicious, we signal it. So these monitoring systems do matter.
Right.
And working with enforcement on those things will bring about curtailment of activity. And even if that simply means refocusing activity to other channels, that's making it harder for the criminals to work. And that probably, and at the same token, that also helps reinforce this activity won't be tolerated by governments. And it really is, so our study, backing up, our study is basically looking at one slice of this kind of activity, just this trade. We have a very conservative estimate of what this could mean worldwide, and the numbers are large.
Right.
We're not encompassing smuggling. We're not encompassing cash wire transfers. We're not encompassing things like trade-in services, which would be very attractive,
right,
to even more attractive than goods trade, because it's much easier to conceal a false price. And I think I would leave it there. I think what we who are involved with this effort to curtail can take solace from is that putting such things in place is helping.
Right.
Okay. We talk about curtailing, eradicating. We may never be able to achieve that.
Sure.
Or rarefy it. But if a result for a country is that now we've taken a stand and we're doing this, and we are, we're certainly moving in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
That's beneficial to the country. That's beneficial to businesses who may want to invest in that country, who are prevented from doing so because of uncertainty associated and collusion with other parties, et cetera. And I think that's where we look to success and motivate our continuing persistence and vigilance on this. So I'm hoping that answers that. And by the way, I want to mention one other thing. The, the focus of this report, again, is fairly limited, but produces kind of an astounding number as a result. There are many other approaches taken, and they're all valid. They're all important parts of getting at this accountability, shedding light on these things. For example, FIU reports and surveys that rely on, you know, what they find in enforcement can really pinpoint the kind of criminal activity in a way that our high elevation analysis really can't. Mm-hmm. We're just looking at suspicious things. The in this regard, I'd also mention so more granular approaches can help, and we're doing some of this with the same kind of analysis at the country level.
Okay.
Recently, we published a report. Channing May of GFI published a report on transnational crime, which is coming up with staggering estimates.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just another way at getting at the same thing: the social costs of tolerating or looking away and not doing much about illicit activity.
Right.